Hello, I'm Jane Crowell, the Editor-in-Chief of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film. It's the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, the lovely Matthew Leyland.
Oh, what a wonderful introduction. Hello.
Well, you are lovely. And this week we are chatting to Kelvin Harrison Jr. and Lucy Boynton about Chevalier. Plus, we're reviewing that as well as mecha actioner Transformers, Rise of the Beasts, First Nation.
That's Wahey. That's a little Wahey.
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 First Nation drama War Pony and Eva Longoria's snack biopic Flaming Hot, which is about Cheetos. Really?
Yes.
Really,
quite
is
a variety pack this isn't week, it? Isn't it? Really?
A lot of stuff to discuss. But before we get on to that, what else have you been watching, Matthew Leyland?
Well, I'm slightly ashamed to say it, but I've finally caught up with Fleabag, which the whole world watched
five years ago.
I'm deep into season two. I watched season one last year, I think, and then I finally moved on to season two. There is a link here with one of the films, though, I would say. I'm absolutely loving it. I've got two more episodes to go, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge is just sublime.
Isn't she?
Her comic timing is just off the charts, brilliant.
Yeah, so, we haven't seen her in Indiana Jones yet. People in Cannes saw it, obviously, Lucky Blighters, but we haven't seen it. But I'm very excited about what she'll bring to that and the snarkiness that she'll bring.
Can't wait.
She's going to be great, I'm sure. Speaking of catching up, I've caught up now. I was on a plane to Memphis and back last week. I caught up with season two of The White Lotus, which I know everyone said it was great. And yeah. It is great. I'm loving it even more than the first season. And I think Jennifer Coolidge is just amazing. She's so Buster Keaton. It's unbelievable.
really? I haven't seen it.
Did
she do a lot of physical stuff then?
No, but it's just the way she emotes in a comedic fashion. Yeah. And her comedic sort of physicality is really good. And she's so sort of sad and comedic. She's just wonderful. Definitely watch that. And also enjoying Theo James being a total douchebag. I interviewed him back in the days of Divergent, when he was going to be the new Robert Pattinson and then wasn't. And I'm liking the choices he's making in his career of that not working out for him. And I think he's pretty good. So yeah, and obviously I love Aubrey Plaza. Who doesn't? And
me too. Yeah,
I can watch her for hours. Fabulous. So yes, I know I'm late to the party, but it's great.
So I'll be even late. I'll be watching that in about 5 years, that one, because I'm way behind.
You are way behind, but it's a good one. Put it on your list. Yeah. And then I started watching The Idol. It's really kind of showgirls for me.
In a both way.
Yeah. Mesmerizing in a can't look away fashion. Yeah.
It's had a lot of coverage, hasn't it? I mean,
it has had a lot of coverage.
Unavoidable.
And it is all of the things that everyone's saying it is. But, you know, Lily Rose Depp is actually really very good in it and fearless. It may not be a great show, but it's certainly the arrival of her as a proper actress, you know, not just playing bit parts in Kevin Smith films, and she's not just, you know, turning up as the queen in Timmy Chalamet's latest thing. Here she is, and she is owning it. So, I think it's quite interesting from that point of view.
She's on the rise.
She is. Okay, so shall we get on to what we can watch at the big screen then?
Yes.
Let's get started with this. Put your wigs on, ladies and gentlemen. It's time for this.
You are quite a remarkable man, Joseph.
I, Marie Antoinette, Queen of France, hereby anoint you Chevalier.
In any other country, a man of your colour would not be wearing such fine clothes.
One day, the whole world will know me.
And of course, the music will be spectacular. Bold.
So this is Chevalier, a biopic of Joseph Bologna, a world-class violinist, composer and fencer, who was erased from history because of his race. Before we get into that and whether it deserves a standing ovation, let's hear what the stars of the film, Kelvin Harrison Jr. playing Chevalier and Lucy Boynton playing Marie Antoinette, had to say about the project when they sat down with Matt Mason earlier this week.
In Chevalier, you both play historical figures, but obviously one's not well known at all, one's really well known. So could you both just sort of introduce your characters and say what expectations you had of them before you did this film, if you knew of them at all? Or
I did not know who he was, so I had no expectations of what he was supposed to be or how he was supposed to go about doing things. I was actually just completely blown away that he even, once I found out what the Chevalier was and how high of a title that was, I was like, how did he get there? But I play Joseph Bologna, who is the son of a slave and a slave owner who had an incredible talent at the age of 4. His father brought him to Paris to put him in Labussiere's Academy, which is like a fencing academy, which he became one of the best fencers in Paris. And he had garnered this intro of Marie Antoinette. And she said she wanted to name the Chevalier, but he also was this incredible violinist that was a contemporary Mozart at the time. And that's my guy.
I play Marie Antoinette. She's very well known, but I think she's very well known in like very specific channels. We all have a very specific preconceived idea of her. And I did too. And so when I read the script, I questioned like if we needed to hear more from her kind of voice. And so then in my research process, it was all about leaving that whole preconceived idea behind and really starting from scratch. And it was a really interesting process. And it was a good opportunity to remind myself to question the author of history books.
And so did that make your preparation quite different? Do you think that obviously you had a lot to draw on, you didn't really have so much information to draw on. Does that make it a different process when you're preparing for your roles?
Maybe, yeah, probably. Right. It would make sense. You know, I remember when I would look in the hidden cameras of, just kidding, you prepping for this role. No, I think
when I would watch you prep, when I watched it you prep, looked different.
I was like, huh, I can assume so.
There's so many resources to pull from. All of them are opinionated and biased. So it's like trying to gather facts versus the experience people had of her and then trying to discern your own kind of third party idea of her. And then again, how it pertains to this story specifically. So it's constantly a pooling of resources and then shaving away at information.
And I'm just adding.
Yeah.
Like sometimes I'm just like, I don't even know if this is even true. Because the thing is that you have to build a human being at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so when you don't have a lot of information, you start to kind of go, well, you start to look at circumstance and being like, okay, well, if these are the laws and these are the parameters, then what would a person do if you have these restrictions? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're the hierarchy of needs and you kind of go, I need these things in order to feel like a person. So I'm going to put this in there. Hopefully it makes it tick.
Do you sort of have a preference for whether you've got a lot of material to draw on or whether you're kind of building it completely from scratch?
I think it's satisfying to get to do one and then the other. Because I think if you only had to do, you know, starting a character from scratch, the possibilities are kind of endless as to where you take it. And so I think it's easier to be much more critical of yourself in that performance or that role. I mean, within the channel that the writers and the directors have created, there's just so much more opportunity to do anything. Whereas it's nice, I kind of like being reined in a little bit with a real person.
And did you have any sort of modern reference points in mind when it came to these characters? Were there sort of people from the present day you sort of thought about when you were building up these characters?
Me and Stephen chose Prince for Joseph. We were like, okay, well, Prince has this like androgynous, like really sexy, kind of like rock star, but, you know, serious, like musician, you know what I mean? Really understands his acts and kind of vibe. And I was like, Joseph's that, but in the 1700s. So I basically, honestly, there were a point where I just kind of looked at Prince compilations. I look in the mirror. I can't believe I'm telling you guys this. I look in the mirror and I would make the same faces. And then I would get this set and I would see, how does this look when I do this? How is Lucy going to react? I just give, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go, yay! Yay!
Yay, you!
And how about you, Lucy? Did you have anyone kind of contemporary in mind?
I didn't really. I think, again, it's that thing of like, I had such a clear reference point for her, so she is the reference in a way, and that makes sense because that's referencing her like public persona, and so then trying to fill in the person behind it, it's constantly bouncing between the two.
And the costumes are amazing in the film, but what are they actually like to wear?
Amazing. I mean it's incredible to wear something that extravagant and that completely other than your own wardrobe and your day-to-day, and it changes the way that you carry yourself completely wearing that kind of corsetry and skin and height and everything. So it's nice to feel completely exited from yourself.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, it's really cool, especially to see you guys in the hair and the gowns and stuff, because like you said, there's the attention to detail and the it's also interesting to see someone want to present themselves with their level of status or class or... It's very much like how we kind of move now. It's like, okay, I'm showing my personality to an extent, except they were like, I'm showing my money. You know what I mean? Well, some people still do that, but it's fun. I think it's just such a huge part of the human experience. And to be able to do it in that period, it's just, yeah. It's a treat.
And how are the wigs as well? Because normally when you're wearing wigs in films, or often they're kind of made to look as realistic as possible. But obviously these are sort of the opposite of that. So are they kind of comfortable? How does it feel when you sort of first see yourself in that?
It's so great when you get to look in the mirror and it's completely foreign to you, I think. And so, yeah, something like a 2-foot wig is going to do that. It was great. I mean, and they were the way that you can construct them in a modern way. I mean, back then it would have been a genuine kind of birdcage under her hair. Incredibly heavy and painful. I had the kind of painless version of it. So you just have to be aware of the candles on set where you're not catching on fire. Yeah.
Or the sparkler that you kept lighting.
Which was so... I was so scared for you. It was like old-timey realness. I almost burnt that beautiful dress. Oh my gosh, I did burn the sofa.
And Kelvin, you've got a very sort of musical background. So did the sort of musical side of this role come easily to you, or was it sort of challenging to... sort of portray the Chevalier, that side of his skills?
It was hard. I was mad at Joseph a little bit. Actually, I was mad at Michael Abels because I expected them to make this a movie and to make me have like really easy musical numbers. And they were like, no. So I had to work really long hours to learn how to play the violin, which was actually a really cool treat. And I'm actually really grateful I got the experience. But it was hard. It was a lot. It was hard on my mental more than anything else, because the idea of trying to learn a song isn't, you're not doing it for the pleasure of like, I just want to play the violin. You're doing it because you know there's a day you have to shoot something, and there's a lot of work that has to go into it. So I think I was more anxious than I was enjoying it, but it was a test of my focus and my discipline.
And just the final question to wrap up on Kelvin, you're also playing Martin Luther King Jr. as well. How did that compare against a figure who's so well known compared to the Chevalier?
There's a lot more footage. They're both interesting because they're both revolutionaries in their own way, you know? But I think with prepping for that particular character was, I can read his autobiography, you know? Joseph doesn't have one. I can watch interviews of his wife. It's a little bit closer in proximity too, so something I can understand. I can talk to my, you know, even my dad's not old enough to really be around, but he was born close enough in time. There's people that are still alive that knew Martin. You don't have any of that with Joseph. But the spirit of someone being able to say, I was called to do A, B, and C, and I'm going to double down on my purpose, is the same kind of tone in terms of the type of guy and the same type of courage and bravery. So it's interesting. We're going to see what that turns out to be, you know?
I can't wait.
So that's Lucy and Kelvin talking about their wigs and not setting fire to them. You know, I mean, you can see that that could go up like a Roman candle.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yeah.
So, Matthew. Hi. Tell us a little bit more about this film. Obviously, we know now that it's about Chevalier, and he was this incredibly gifted young man who was a friend of Marie Antoinette. But what are the sort of machinations that are going on in this slice of his life?
So it's set in Paris around kind of revolution is brewing, and that's kind of in the background of the film, but comes more to the fore as it goes on. And he's an aspiring composer. There's a Marie Antoinette poses a competition for someone to write an opera for her, and the person who wins this competition will get one of the top jobs, will kind of ascend in her favor. So he enters this competition. So that kind of gives like the backbone to the story. And then there's a romantic subplot between him and Samara Weaving's opera singer character, but she's also married, so that kind of introduces some tension into the mix as well. So it's basically following him and his kind of struggles with, obviously, with the kind of deeply ingrained racism of the time, of him having to prove himself as this composer to gain notice. And then, yes, we have like the French Revolution is brewing as well. So that kind of interweaves with his story. And it takes various kind of dramatic twists and turns all the while he's trying to get this opera together. So we have all these musical interludes as well in this a kind of a snapshot biopic, really. It's not kind of cradle to grave. It does kind of focus on a short period in his life. but kind of illuminating, you know, this figure who, as you say, was kind of erased from history.
Yeah, I mean, he was an incredible person. You know, he set Mozart's teeth on edge by being brilliant with his violin. You know, he was a world-class fencer, a composer, and by all accounts, quite a sexy man about town. Helvin did say that, you know, he'd sort of modelled him slightly on Prince, and you can see that. But does it work? Is this, you know, doing justice to Joseph's story? And does it get you fired up, Matthew?
Well, the thing is, it kind of saves the best for first, really, because the first scene involving him and Mozart, which is teased a bit too much in the trailer, is sensational. It's kind of this battle between him and Mozart. And you think, wow, this is going to be so dynamic and energetic and in your face and irreverent. And but then it kind of just steadily peters from there, really. It never kind of hits those heights again. So that was quite disappointing, really, because it is such a cracking opener. And you think, wow, this is going to really be sensational. But it just kind of bogs down really into a sort of biopic template. I mean, the romance between him and Samara Weaving, it kind of, there's a few sparks there. It's quite playful at times, but it never really kind of takes off. And the competition dynamic that's sort of the spine of the story, that never really kind of reaches a sort of critical flashpoint where you can get truly involved in it. So, I mean, it's very sort of polished, well-made, well-acted, great wigs. But overall, it just leaves you wanting a bit more, and you just can't help comparing it to that opening scene, really.
Yeah, or comparing it to Amadeus, which had so much sort of, I mean, if you're thinking about the sort of punk prince-esque sort of flamboyance that we see in Amadeus, and the fact that in that portrayal of a genius, it's warts and all, you know, he's not designed to be necessarily likable. And in this, it feels like they really want you to love Chevalier. He's given arrogance, but in a cutesy way. He's very polished, as you say. He's pretty. The sort of sex and romance doesn't feel sort of raunchy or sexy. It feels lacking any kind of spark. It's very sanitized. And that sort of the verve we see in that opening scene is never regained again. Kelvin Harrison Jr. is, you know, he played B.B. King in Elvis and managed to shine in that tiny role. Here, he's sort of lost and swamped by the rest of the stuff. He's swamped in production design, in costume, in Mini Driver, you know, wiping the floor with him in scenes. not that she is to be diminished, but that her role is quite small, and yet she makes a lasting impression. And Marie Antoinette, again, is sort of like just a sort of cake standing in the corner within this drama. And, you know, she's, when you think about even Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, we've seen this done with more, you know, punk rock verve. And so it feels just like a lovely concoction that doesn't really make the blood course through your veins.
Yeah. I mean, it's great to have this film that is kind of raising awareness of this figure, this very important historical figure that, you know, more people will know about him and perhaps want to go off and read more about him and listen to his works. But yeah, as a biopic, it's not really that inspiring or inspired.
It reminded me a little bit of Belle in the same way that, God, this is such an important story, and we should feel angry about these people being erased from history, and we should feel angry about the racism, but it's sort of done in such a palatable fashion and such a gentle way, so as not to frighten the horses, that it renders it pointless. So, I was sort of disappointed. I had great hopes for it, but I ended up feeling just sort of massaged by vanilla, basically.
Yeah.
You can't be massaged by vanilla. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, because we ran a feature on it and it sounded really intriguing, and the way they were talking it up, but it just feels like something's perhaps been lost on the way to the screen. You know, clearly the intention was there to really kind of celebrate this figure and bring him to attention, really get people excited, but somehow it just hasn't kind of reached fruition on the screen, which is a real shame. And it does feel just a bit small screen to me, really.
Yeah, I mean, it would be perfectly nice to watch on a plane. It wouldn't challenge you. and wouldn't necessarily move you into that, you know, where you end up blubbing over films at high altitude because you've had a glass of wine and it's high altitude and you're hungry and tired. Maybe it would inject a little bit more emotion into it if you were in a plane seat. But really, I'm not sure I would recommend that people spend their money seeing this at the cinema.
Not really, no. Maybe if you're particularly interested in that period of history or music, classical music, or maybe not. as you're sort of Friday night viewing. Yeah.
If you enjoy a big skirt and a high wig and beautiful costumes and gorgeous production design, and you want to know a little bit more about Joseph Bologna, I mean, he is a fascinating character. What an amazing person he was. And this would be a good primer to go and explore him more. But I don't think you're going to be completely satisfied by it as your one and only entry point to him.
Yeah, I think it's a three-starer.
Perfectly nice, but just a shame it wasn't a little bit more spiky.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you fancy a little bit of Chevalier, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, should we move on to something that has no wigs involved and no huge bustles? It's time to take a spin with this one. Thank you, Holden.
This is not our war.
Optimus, we must trust each other to protect the home we all share.
How big can this guy be?
He eats planets. So, like, way bigger than a planet.
In the end, everything you cared for will be consumed.
Matthew Leyland.
Hi.
This is Transformers Rise of the Beasts.
Rise of the Beasts.
How is this one different to the ones we've seen before?
Well, that's a very good question. Yes, I mean, this is the... I had to top them up because I'd lost track. This is the seventh film in the Transformers series. So you had the first five directed by Michael Bay, all set in the present. The most recent one was Bumblebee, which is set in the 80s, and now this one moves on and it's set in the 90s. Well, once again, we've got the Autobots, we've got Optimus Prime, Bumblebee, a couple of new ones, and they're facing off against the Terracons in this one, and their master, Unicron, who's quite a long-standing character in the franchise, who eats planets.
Yeah.
And we've also got the Maximals. They're the kind of the new selling point here. I mean, previously we had the Dinobots, and these are the Maximals. So these are animal robots who have a link to the Transformers history. And basically it comes down to trying to stop this giant mouth eating our planet, basically. That's the kind of gist of it.
With a sort of gorilla bot and a bird bot.
Yeah. Played by Michelle Yeoh. She's the bird bot.
Michelle, you've got an Oscar, love. Don't do that. Yeah.
And you've got two humans in the middle. You've got Anthony Ramos from In the Heights and Dominique Fishback from Judas and the Black Messiah. Yeah, these two characters who separately meet the Transformers. And there's a MacGuffin that they come into contact with, this kind of key that will start the whole planet-eating process. So it's kind of business as usual, but set in the 90s. So it's got a 90s soundtrack, 90s vibe, 90s technology.
I didn't see this because I was going around Graceland. You're not really selling it to me, I have to say. I'm surprised that people like Anthony Ramos and Michelle Yeoh are in this film because it sounds like a very kiddie thing. Is it for kids? Is it something that you could enjoy if you take your kids to the cinema?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there's constant action. There's hardly any lulls in the action or bits where the robots aren't on screen, you know, perhaps some setup to begin with. But I would say the first half is the more sort of compelling half where it does kind of build up the human interest. And perhaps, I mean, the most appealing thing about this in comparison to the Michael Bay directed ones is that, I mean, those kind of had a lot of sort of crass humor and lechery, at their worst, at their lowest. There's quite a lot of sexism, leering going on. And that all seems to have, I mean, starting with Bumblebee, that they seem to have expunged a lot of that from the franchise now. So, I mean, that's a really nice progression that they've got here. And there's still relatively few female characters, but at least we do have a couple of female Transformers, and all the female characters have agency and power and their intelligence. So it is nice to have that. But at the same time, in the action is quite similar to Bayhem.
Yeah. But that's probably what you want from a Transformers movie, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And there certainly is a lot of that. But I would say it's kind of lacking some of the charm of Bumblebee. I mean, I thought for me, Bumblebee was the high point of the franchise so far because that kind of shrunk it down a bit more. That had a bit more of an E.T. kind of aspect to it, and this relationship between Hayley Steinfeld's character and Bumblebee. And you do get some of that here, particularly in this first hour, but the second hour it kind of escalates again. But it does, it borrows quite heavily from certain Marvel movies of the past few years. There's a lot of similarities there. So it's kind of, it's semi-successful. I mean, yeah, for me, it's another sort of solid three-starer.
But perfectly decent, but isn't going to live long in your memory after you've seen it.
Not really. No, I think it does depend on the sort of affection you have for the Transformers franchise. You know, if you're keen to see bits of scrap metal smashing each other, you know, ripping each other's heads off and spines out and all that kind of stuff and spilling engine fluid all over the screen. But yeah, I think you'll have fun with it.
And the 90s component, is that fun to watch? I mean, because I love a bit of retro stuff. So if you're doing like 90s phones and stuff like that, I'm kind of into it.
They're fairly restrained with that. They don't go too far. It's just a few references. It's mostly in the soundtrack, and there's some cool needle drops, particularly towards the end. There's one sort of really crowd-pleasing, air-punching moment that got the crowd going absolutely wild at the multimedia. I mean, I won't spoil it, but yeah, that's a high point here. So it's mostly in the soundtrack, cool. And there's a few sort of references here and there.
And I assume it leaves it open for a further adventure of the Transformers.
Of course, yes.
So will we be getting a 2000 version?
Yeah, that's kind of what you'd expect, isn't it? Yeah, because these are all supposed to be set. These are set before the kind of Shia LaBeouf ones that started in the mid-noughties. So that sort of time period is getting more narrow for them to fit in more. So, yeah, but presumably they will do one. And without spoilers, there are hints of how the franchise will broaden. I'll just say the word crossover at the end.
Enticing.
Which is kind of, intriguing, but at the same time it was a bit, really.
But they're clearly making money, aren't they, these films? If they're making money, they're making more films and they're managing to draw big names in. So it must be a decent paycheck.
Yeah, well, yeah, because you've got some of the voice. You've got Peter Dinklage plays the lead Terracon. And then the ape Optimus Primal is played by Ron Perlman. And yeah, we mentioned Michelle Yeoh playing this slightly strange bird. She's like a robot bird, but with feathers, which is a bit strange about the Maximals. They all have fur and feathers.
Yeah. So how's this happened?
I have no idea.
How is it organic and also metallic?
It's never explained. You just accept it, which kind of works as a toy. You know, that's fine. I'm happy with that. Or even in a cartoon or a comic. But yeah, in live action, there are a few sort of gaps in logic where you're like,
excuse me, can we just halt? I have some questions about genetics.
Yes. Yes, perhaps that's a subject for a future movie, how the gorilla got this luxuriant head of hair when he seems to be entirely robotic. I did have questions.
Okay, so would you recommend that this is a big screen experience? Is it worth seeing this on a big screen? I imagine it is the action.
Yes, yeah, we saw it in IMAX, and yeah, I can feel the rumbling in my chest, you know, from every kind of impact. Yeah, and the effects they work very well on the big screen, especially when the action expands. Yes, it's a proper summer, absolute proper summer blockbuster, loads of action. Oh, I should mention Pete Davidson, who's kind of a scene stealer. He plays the Autobot who befriends Anthony Ramos's character. He plays Mirage, and he's very, very funny. He has lots of great lines. But he's sort of diminished a bit towards the end, but certainly in the first half, he's a real scene stealer, and I really enjoyed him.
It's and Pete Davidson's summer. Yeah, he's in Fast X as well.
Yeah, and donuts. Guardians 3.
And he Guardians.
Yeah. Is he in Barbie? Is he in Oppenheimer?
He could be. Maybe he's popping a fuse in at Nolan's. Who knows? Who knows? Pete Davidson, constantly everywhere. Okay, so we are saying, do go and see this. Get your big popcorn, get your big drink.
Yeah.
Leave your brain at the door and enjoy this on a big screen.
Yes, I would. Yes. Family outing. Yeah.
So that is Transformers Rise of the Beasts, and it is out in cinemas on Friday. Let's get real now. There's no Transformers in this one. It's this.
I heard you got an expensive new dog and a fancy job.
You mad at me?
No, I don't expect much from you.
Don't bring no drama into my TV, okay?
What's the problem?
If you let me stay, I'll work for you for free.
I don't speak Lakota.
So this is War Pony. Matthew, tell us about this. It debuted at Cannes this year.
Yeah, so you remember War Horse, Steven Spielberg's World War One epic. This has absolutely nothing to do with that.
Not the sequel.
Completely unrelated. Yeah, it's not a sequel. It's not a prequel. So yeah, just totally forget about that. Yes, this is War Pony. It's the co-directing debut of Riley Keough and Vina Kamel. Yeah, it's all set on the Pine Ridge Reservation in Dakota. It's kind of quite a sort of loose plot, but it does follow these two. Well, one's a boy, Matho, and there's the older Bill. I mean, Bill is certainly, he's kind of struggling to make ends meet. He's kind of looking for any way really to make a quick buck. And his latest scheme is selling poodles. He comes across his dog and he plans to sell this on. Meanwhile, in this sort of parallel plot, we've got Matho, who's this young boy who's kind of adrift at school. He doesn't really have much kind of parental guidance. He's getting into all sorts of substances and trouble. So he's just sort of kicking around in a sort of classic kind of teen movie fashion. And there's quite lots of other various characters in the mix, but we do kind of cut back and forth between them and following their various fortunes and misfortunes. And then things sort of dovetail towards the end. And it does kind of emerge that there is more of a sort of an overall sort of arc to the whole film.
This is written by Riley and Gina, but by embedding with the Oglata Lakota, and had a lot of input from them. So it's co-written by various people from that reservation as well. But yeah, it's very much reminds me of a sort of Chloe Zhao and The Outsiders, Coppola's The Outsiders, in this sort of idea of sort of, it feels really aimless to begin with, doesn't it? And it's very sort of immersive, and you just feel like you're hanging out with these guys along for the ride. And then the drama starts to ratchet up, and there seems to be just something portentous coming. The feeling of dread starts, and something bad is going to happen. These people are very hard scrabble. They're living hand to mouth. They're living in sort of knackered homes with no real work to speak of. As you say, little Mathos has a very abusive father, very violent, and he has to sort of survive on his own. Bill has two baby mamas who he's trying to provide for and no real career prospects. And then into this also comes this turkey farmer who Bill meets on a road and becomes part of his life and is sort of taken under the wing of, with terrible, dire results. I loved this. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I thought it was absolutely terrific. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it did take me a little while to kind of orientate myself and get used to the characters and where it was going, and understanding what the sort of dynamics were. But yeah, once it kind of clicked for me, I thought it was absolutely terrific. Just felt so kind of authentic and lived in. It didn't sort of feel contrived or melodramatic, even though lots of big things happen. There's lots of big incidents, and it does all come to a head. And there's kind of a sting in the tail for some of the characters at the end, which I thought the payoff was really satisfying, the ending of the film, which obviously won't spoil. But yeah, and I thought the two main boys, they were just absolutely fantastic, really compelling to watch, felt so kind of natural.
Yeah, and sort of a bit like Larry Clark's kids in that way of sort of seeing these young actors sort of plucked from obscurity and given the freedom to sort of express themselves and how incredible they are. I mean, both of them are incredible. But also weaving into that, this idea of these young kids growing up between two worlds, they're sort of often present to sort of rituals and things that the older generation are taking part in the full sort of heritage dress and the drumming circles and things like that. But they can't relate to that. But equally, they're at parties where people very much view them as alien and not, you know, as part of their society, and there's a party scene that happens that is incredibly uncomfortable to watch with various things that happen. And one of the characters that I really enjoyed was the turkey farmer's wife, just awful and terrible, you know, this sort of latent racism and white savior complex and everything that is awful, but so subtle, so subtly done, you know, like in comparison to Chevalier, where we have this big bad in Chevalier who is the husband of you know, Chevalier's lover, who is just moustache twirlingly bad and a big old white racist.
Yeah, he really is.
This one is so nuanced and so realistic and feels so real, all the more horrifying for it.
It's quite hard watch in places. It's quite despairing, and and seeing these children, the kind of lives that they're living is it's quite alarming and upsetting. But so empathetic at the
same. Empathetic, and aspects of it sort of really made me think of Wind River as well. That sort of idea of the native people that are on the land that, you know, white people are coming into, just being so disposable and used. And there's a lot of abuse in various different levels of First Nation people in this. Yeah, it's just great. And the soundtrack's amazing as well. That's what I really loved about it. Really, you know, great songs that really illustrate the characters and how they feel and how they position themselves in the world. But also then this beautiful soundtrack that goes in and out, and also the sort of heritage sort of native sounds as well, all interwoven. And then this great needle drop when a certain thing happens, which is completely at odds with everything else. And I loved it. And it put a smile on my face.
Yeah.
Come and get your love. Oh, that was good. But no, the come and get your love. Like such a great choice. I loved it. And I just think this is such an assured debut by Riley and Gina. Great. They have real handle on their material. And I'm really interested to see what they might do next.
I'd love to see them sort of follow these characters as they grow, you know, maybe come back in a few years in a sort of Before Sunrise type fashion and kind of follow them, see where they're going. Because, it's just, so involving and fascinating, as well as being quite hard to watch.
Yeah, and I do hope they're in a better place than we find them here. But, I didn't want to leave them behind. I sort of, you get into a sort of feeling like you really know them. And I felt quite sort of sad when it finished, because I was like, I really was quite enjoying just riding along with them.
Yeah, it really did just build and build for me. I just got much more invested in it as it went along, and did end up loving it.
Cool. Okay, so I think we're saying we highly recommend War Pony.
Highly, yeah.
Okay, absolutely. War Pony is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, crack open the snacks, everyone.
I got an idea. It's a spicy chip. It's going to change everything.
It will save our factory.
And you're a janitor.
No, hang on.
Figure out the next step. Say, the Hispanic market will not be ignored.
The Hispanic market will not be ignored.
Good, but in your voice. You got the fire
inside. Why are we wasting time on this janitor's crazy idea?
Guys like you and me, we don't get shots like this.
You see that guy right there? I see a chingon, a montañez.
Yo soy montañez.
De montañez.
Get out there and be great.
So Matthew, this is Flaming Hot, the story of Cheetos. Tell us how on earth there's a story in that.
Well, this is part of this weird trend this year of biopics of objects, things like we've had Air about the Air Jordans, we've got the Blackberry movie, Tetris.
We've got the Beanie Babies movie coming up.
Beanie Babies movie. It's just,
Barbie.
Barbie, I mean, how this has happened is just fascinating. It makes me think there's someone pulling the strings in Hollywood who just decided, you know, we need biopics of things.
When am I getting my biopic of Twinkies?
I'm sure they're all in the works. I'm sure, you know, it's going to happen. Someone will be pitching it somewhere.
So this is about, like, the spicy snack. Tell us, who invented it and why is it worth watching?
This is essentially a biopic of Richard Montanez, who was working in the Cheetos factory. Well, according to the movie, I mean, this has been disputed in various reports, but his invention, according to this movie, was to create flaming hot Cheetos, so effectively taking the corn snack and making them a lot spicier. And he kind of fought to do this. He had to, as he's on quite a low level, so he's being quite ignored, being patronized by his white bosses. But he came up with this idea and eventually kind of brought it to fruition, made it a great success. And this is the story of how he did that, how he kind of clung on and kept fighting and found various ways to get people's attention with this spicy snack. So effectively, it's about how kind of gaining notice for the Hispanic community as well, you know, because they're being overlooked and ignored. So he's kind of doing this. This is for them. This is to kind of get them more of a kind of attention, you know, designing a product that's going to appeal more to them because they're this great untapped market as well in this movie. So it is as much, it's a kind of an underdog story. And it's, we should say, it's Eva Longoria's directorial debut.
Which is curious, to go from Desperate Housewives to directing a film about crisps. But she does put her stamp on it in terms of, you know, really leaning into that culture and making sure that her actors really do that as well. And that whole idea of, you know, as you say, it's a sort of the American dream, but told through the Hispanic community, which isn't often given that platform. No. And the idea that, you know, this bland cheese snack could take off in such a huge way if you just looked at who would enjoy that snack, if you tinkered with it and made it. I mean, his child says he loves it if it burns in a good way.
Yes.
It burns.
In a
good way. Yes. Good, you know, if it's a good burn.
Yeah.
That spiciness. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, I would say, if it was an essay you read in a magazine. I'm not sure I needed to see a film about it.
Yeah, it kind of, it does really stick to the, even though it's a kind of, it's kind of highlighting an area that hasn't, that deserves to be highlighted. And it's obviously, it's a kind of a micro history that people might not be aware of, but it does really stick to quite a generic biopic template, the plucky underdog. So there's lots of kind of like inspirational speeches, there's mentor figures. Yeah, the loving wife who's kind of, you know, she's always kind of in the background, undaunted in her support, but doesn't really feel like she comes into her own as a character, unfortunately. Like montages and like setbacks, then triumphs. I mean, it's on Disney Plus and it does feel quite a bit like a TV movie in places.
And this is sort of like the late 70s and 80s, so there's lots of that production value going on. I assume intentional on Longoria's part that she sort of leans into that sort of 80s-ness of it in terms of directorial style and flourish as well. But that just weirdly makes it feel even more like an old-fashioned, as you say, TV movie. And so it didn't feel particularly pertinent or particularly sort of having any new thing to say about this story. It felt very much trapped in amber. So while I found it kind of interesting to know how spicy Cheetos came about, I don't think I needed it in my life necessarily. Yeah. And I didn't feel that I'd learned a huge amount about the originator of it.
Yeah. And he has like this conflict with his dad that's going through the film. And that sort of felt by the numbers to me, really, the way it's kind of set up and it progresses and the way it's eventually resolved. I did feel like I'd kind of seen a lot of these elements done many times before. And there are quite a few flourishes in there. I mean, there's kind of a device which is sort of was used in the Ant-Man movies where characters kind of narrate an incident, but in their own voice. So you see the other actor speaking with their voice. It's better done by Michael Peña, really, in the Ant-Man movies. And you just can't help kind of comparing it to that. I thought some of the production values weren't the best, really, in terms of the wigs. I don't know how you felt about
the wigs.
Shalhoub's wig and Haysbert's wig.
This is what I'm saying. I'm like, I can only assume it was intentional to sort of go into that sort of, you know, in the 80s when you watched a TV biopic, they were terrible wigs. I'm like, surely these wigs are intentional to sort of give it that vibe. Because if not, Longoria needs to have a word with their hair and makeup team because they were terrible. But I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt that this is all intentional.
Yeah. I enjoyed Dennis Haysbert. I mean, he has such kind of gravitas in everything he does. I enjoyed his scenes, but perhaps like the kind of scripted exchanges between him and Richard, they do kind of feel a bit familiar. You sort of see the arc, how it's going to pan out as soon as it starts, as soon as he meets. He's like Dennis Haysbert, but he's kind of playing this sort of senior person on the on the shop floor, and he kind of guides Richard in his journey.
Yeah, I mean, and it is an incredible, obvious, you know, ascent. He was the janitor at Tito's, and he became, you know, an exec and a person who really saw a gap in the market and convinced people to exploit that in order to make the business much stronger. And, you know, he took himself from, you know, a petty car thief to somebody who was making really good money. So in that respect, it's really kind of interesting to see somebody do that and to understand where they're coming from and what motivated them. But yeah, I don't think anyone's going to lose sleep if they don't see this.
No. And I think kind of following Air, I mean, Air wasn't perfect, but I thought the way that kind of depicted like the marketing of a product, the kind of negotiations and the lingo involved with that, I thought that did it in a lot kind of a snappier way than it's
and
done
better
here.
Better wigs, Matthew, better wigs.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Okay, well, if you do fancy a bit of this, I mean, we would suggest, obviously, as well, you kind of need some crisps whilst you're watching it. Maybe that's where we went wrong. We needed the Cheetos in our laps in a bowl whilst we're watching this. Flaming Hot is on Disney Plus from Friday.
It ain't easy being cheesy.
That's all we've got time for. What's your film of the week, Matthew?
Oh, War Pony.
Same. Heads and shoulders above everything else.
Easily.
Honestly, if you can seek this out, it is a cracker. It takes a while to bed in, but I think it will get a hold of your heart and you'll be thinking about it for some time afterwards.
Yeah.
A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you could make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now and you're all set. And a reminder that our issue is still on sale with our exclusive on Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan's biopic of the father of the atomic bomb. We can't wait to see that. Still haven't seen it. Desperate to. Mr. Nolan, please show it to us. We want to see it.
I'll be seeing. The countdown has begun.
Yes, indeed. Come on. But before we go, we have time for a listener's question. And this is obviously linked to the Cheetos. What snack should they make a biopic of?
Ooh, that's a big one. I mean, we've known each other a long time, but there's probably a few things you don't know about me.
Where's this going?
Well, yes. Well, one of the things I'm going to confess to is when I was, as a young lad, I was a member of the Curly Whirly fan club.
I didn't know they had one.
Yes, exactly. So
what did you learn about Curly Whirlies in a fan club?
Pretty much zero, less than zero. But I got a lot of nice stickers and some newsletters, like a moose mascot, I seem to remember.
Oh, a moose animal. Not, you didn't get a Curly Whirly moose dessert.
No, moose as in, the antlers. And
what? I didn't know there was a moose as a mascot for Curly Whirly. I'm learning things already.
I mean, this has been lost in the sands of history, and this is why we need a biopic of Curly Whirlies, and I would be first in line on opening night to see this movie.
I mean,
hands down.
I'd like to know mostly how they were massive and really hard when you were a kid, and you used to have to really chew them, get into them.
You really did.
And now they're just a soft, tiny thing that you can eat in three bites. What happened?
They were, weren't they? Yeah, they were like the size of a school ruler when we were kids.
Yeah.
And it's like wagon wheels. They've just shrunk down. It's a travesty.
Everything's smaller. I got a Mars bar the other day that was full size, and I honestly thought I'd got a fun size one. What is going on?
I thought inflation was the trend, not kind of...
I thought all of our portions were getting bigger. Apparently, they're not getting bigger in confectionery. Okay, mine would be Jaffa cakes,
that's a good one.
Jaffa cakes have a very interesting history because, biscuits in general. Biscuits are incredibly important historically and socially to all of us because they used to be cakes and sweet things, used to be the preserve of the rich. And then the sugar industry, obviously, with some very bleak history in British history particularly, came in and made sugar more widely available. And then biscuits could become more widely available to middle and lower classes. But also... that sugar helped them, you know, keep fresh for longer so that you could then package them. You could send out tins of biscuits. So that whole idea of a sort of marketable fast food came in with biscuits. And Jaffa cakes were a thing that have had a very long history. Mm. And Jaffa cakes were like subject to a tax, massive tax court case where...
Really?
You were taxed differently whether something was a cake or a biscuit. So there was a court case to decide whether a Jaffa cake was a cake or a biscuit. Spoiler alert,
this
a cake.
This is amazing. It's a cake.
So you get taxed differently on it because it is a cake. But they had people arguing in court about the various aspects of a Jaffa cake and why that constituted a biscuit or a cake, and like when you ate it, how many you ate, what the density of the sponge was, if it came in a packet, if it didn't. It's extraordinary, right? And then I was once in a job interview where one of their like quirky questions was, is a Jaffa cake a cake or a biscuit? To see
and you answered, sort of, obviously.
Well, as a nerd of biscuit history, I obviously said this was a cake, and for the reasons. Yeah. But it is apparently an interview question designed to sort of test your sort of ability to think on the fly. So I think all of that.
And you've Jaffa been editor cake, of Total Film ever since.
I mean, it wasn't that interview, but I just think, come on, if you can make a story out of a Nike shoe or indeed a Cheeto, where's our Jaffa cake biopic?
Yeah, it's just a shame that Sidney Lumet's no longer with us to do this courtroom drama that would surely be winning Oscars and getting them queuing around the block. Yeah. You know,
get Brendan Fraser in there as the arguing lawyer. We could make this very dramatic, I think. So, any producers out there who would like that idea, we'll just call it Jaffa. No.
Jaffa.
You could muddle that up with other things. It's going to have to be Jaffa cake, isn't it? Have your Jaffa cake and eat it. We need to workshop this a bit more, don't we? But I feel
we've got the seed of an idea here, which we're going to run.
Film in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Definitely. Well, on that note, please tell us on Twitter if you have ideas for confectionery or snack-based films, because clearly there's money in it, and Hollywood really wants these ideas, so we need to be sending them in. But on that note, let's come to a close with this. I think it's biscuit time right now. I might go off and have a couple of biscuits with a cup of tea. I don't know about you. Don't have any Jaffa cakes, but now I've discussed them, I feel like I need to pop to Tesco's.
I think, yeah.
And none of this fancy business. None of this Jaffa cake with mint in it or a different filling. Only the orange.
And the little sort of squishy bars you can get now as well for Jaffa cake.
I'm not having any of that. No.
No, it's got to be a proper old
proper
school
Jaffa cake.
OG Jaffa. Yeah.
And none of this pretenders. Also, did you know, they didn't patent the Jaffa cake. So anyone can make a Jaffa cake, which is very silly.
Oh, really?
I feel like there'd be a very dramatic scene there where someone goes, oh, man, I forgot.
We forgot the patent.
I went out drinking and that patent is still in my bag. Doesn't matter, does it? And then fast forward to Marks and Spencer's Jaffa Cakes and Sainsbury's and everyone else's.
Floodgates open.
Yeah.
It'd be a great montage.
Yeah. So there we go. That's amazing. Thanks for attending my TED talk on Jaffa Cakes. and we will be back next week with more films. So for now, let's say goodbye. Say goodbye, Matthew.
Bye-bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Bye-bye.